You're listening to Live from Lord North Street, a podcast from the Institute of Economic Affairs. Today's podcast features the IEA's Head of Education, Dr. Steve Davies, being interviewed by Digital Officer Madeline Grant about his theory on the coming realignment of modern political parties in the West. Coming up, Steve explains his predictions, and he and Madeline dig deeper into the political ramifications of Brexit, the election of Donald Trump, and the future of libertarianism in an increasingly populist climate. If you like what you hear, be sure to check out our website, iea.org.uk, and subscribe to our YouTube channel, username IEA London.
Steve, your theory of modern political realignment would have us living in a world that looks very different to the one we have today. Can you explain your thesis to us?
The thesis that I want to argue is that the way to make sense of politics today, or indeed in many periods of the past, is that we are experiencing a political realignment. What does that mean? What it means is that the way in which political debates are ordered, the fundamental divisions in society are changing. This has happened many times before, but it's happening with particular rapidity at the moment. So how to understand how this works? If you think of a human society as being like a very large number of people in a very large room, at any given point in time, there are certain things that all the people living in this very large room have to decide collectively. And naturally, they're going to disagree in many cases about what exactly should be done. They will disagree because of different beliefs, different sentiments and feelings, or different interests. But although they disagree about many, many things, at any given period in time, there are only certain basic issues of disagreement which tend to be the ones that everything else is related to. So the people in this hypothetical very large room, a political society in our sense, they will define themselves as being on one side or the other of just a very small number of key issues, key disagreements. And it's those key issues and key disagreements that then define who is on one side or the other, right or left, in or out. What this means, of course, is that people who in many ways disagree about many things will find themselves lumped together in the same camp because they happen to be on the same side of the crucial or critical or particularly salient political disagreement in that society at that time and place. At the same time, it also means that certain combinations of views or positions and perspectives will either not exist at all or will simply be disregarded and ignored and barely articulated because, again, they don't engage with or fit into the major disagreements that divide society. After a certain number of years, however, what happens is that the disagreements become exhausted. Typically, what you find is that one side of or the other gains a clear advantage, tends to basically win the argument. At the same time, the conditions of the people in the political society change. There is social change, there's economic change, there's technological innovation, all of which means that the divisions in society of interest and often outlook and consciousness start to change as well. So people stop disagreeing about certain issues and new disagreements arise. And when those new disagreements arise, what then happens is that you get a realignment where the divisions within the room, in my metaphor, the political society, are centred around these new disagreements rather than the old ones. Or the old disagreements are recombined in a different way. So let's see how this actually works out. Since the 1970s, roughly, in most Western democracies, there have been two major issues of disagreement amongst the public and the political class. The first of these is over how extensive the economic role of government should be. On the one side, there are people who think that the economic role of government should be limited, that governments should not levy very high rates of taxation, should not intervene extensively in the economy, should not engage in major redistribution of income or wealth from one social group to another. In other words, there are people who are broadly on what you might call the free market or limited government side. On the other side are people who think that actually there is a very large active role that government should play in any good society, that governments need to provide a wide range of goods, that governments should be engaged in an extensive welfare program aimed at providing a living standard floor under the poor, or perhaps in redistributing wealth and income from the better off to the less well off. And these people also think typically that the economy needs to be quite highly regulated and controlled by the political process in order to avoid adverse social outcomes of one kind or another, whether environmental or of another kind. That's one basic division between what you might call the social democratic or socialist left on the one side and the free market right on the other. The other basic disagreement or axis of disagreement is over whether or not the government, the state, the political process, should support and sustain a particular set of moral values. On the one side, you have people who think that the government should, through laws, favour and encourage certain kinds of moral code, that the government should be concerned with, for example, people's sexual behaviour and activity, should give recognition and status to certain kinds of sexual relationship and not to others, or should actively discourage others, that the government should, for example, penalise the expression of certain kinds of speech regarded as obscene or corrupting, or that the government should be concerned with the kind of things that people eat or choose to ingest, the kind of mood-altering drugs that they should tend to use, and the like. On the other side are people who think that the government should not be concerned with these things, that the government should in fact not seek to support or enforce traditional gender roles, traditional ways of organising households, traditional ways of living, that people should be allowed to live the way they want, which might include, for example, using mood-altering substances, even if others may disapprove of what they do. So the division here is between what you might call the socially liberal or socially libertarian on the one side and the socially authoritarian or small-c conservative on the other. So those are the two big axes of division since the 1970s. Now, the way that politics has actually worked out is that most of the argument has tended to take place between people who have two combinations of views on those two issues. On the one side are people who combine support for limited role for government in economics, the free market position if you will, with support for cultural and social conservatism, government authoritarianism if you like, in the field of sexual, personal relations, use of drugs and the like. Their opposites, the other side of most contemporary politics since the 1970s, are people who combine support for personal liberty, social liberty on the one side, with support for an extensive role for the state in economics on the other. Social democrats, if you will. And if you look, for example, at the United States, this is clearly the basic division between Republicans on the one side, Democrats on the other, conservatives in the American terminology, liberals in the American terminology on the other. It's worth pointing out that there are two combinations of views which don't get reflected by this. There are, on the one hand, the consistent libertarians who think that government should neither have a big economic role nor have a large role in regulating social life. And on the other side, there are the consistent authoritarians who think that the state should have a large role in both of these areas. The people from these two particular positions, because their views, the disagreement between them is not the dominant disagreement, have to decide which half of their set of beliefs they prioritise. So if you are a consistent libertarian, for example, you may decide that economic liberty is what really matters to you and throw in your lot with the contemporary conservatives, or you may decide that social liberty is what matters and throw in your lot more with the contemporary social democratic left. Conversely, if you're a consistent authoritarian, again, you may need to decide which of the two halves of your particular standpoint you adhere to. It's also worth pointing out that there are a whole number of views that simply don't fit into this and which are not actually captured or reflected. Classical Republican views, for example, a whole range of other kind of political positions just simply don't get paid attention to in this vision. Environmental politics, for example, is hard to fit into this kind of schema because that's a different disagreement. But it's not that those are not the dominant or primary disagreements. Now, what I think is true to say is that that division has become exhausted in the way that I described. The usual conventional way of describing this is that the right, if you would call it that, has won the economic argument and the left has won the cultural argument. So generally speaking, there are now very, very few people who would support a completely state-controlled economy or a wide and extensive role for government planning of the economy. The fact that markets have to play at the very least a large role and probably a dominant role in economic life is generally conceded. At the same time, traditionalist conservatism, which thinks that the state has a central role to play in upholding traditional moral values and a particular set of ideas about human personal relationships, is also now very much a minority view. Social liberalism has become predominant. So the division is really exhausted. What I think is now happening is that we are seeing new divisions appear in this hypothetical large room in Western political societies. The new divisions are mainly centred around questions of identity. And in particular, they're centred around, on the one side, people who favour maintaining, upholding and strengthening traditional, settled and established identities, and who typically favour the local, the national, the particular, as opposed to people who think that it's good that the world is changing, that identities are in flux, and who tend to emphasise rather the global, the universal, the cosmopolitan, rather than the specific and local. This new division has interacted with what is left of the old divisions to mean that now, increasingly, the division that we're seeing emerging in most Western democracies is of this kind. On the one side, you have people who are broadly free market, broadly socially liberal, and also strongly globalist, cosmopolitan, and internationalist in their outlook, and also typically culturally individualist, welcoming of change, welcoming of cultural innovation. On the other side is an emerging group who are in favour of quite extensive state intervention in the economy, and typically very much in favour of the welfare state, but on a national basis typically, rather than an international one, who are also at the same time culturally traditionalist and authoritarian, and who above all are opposed to globalism, opposed to cosmopolitanism, and want to assert a very thick, strong version of traditional, national, or ethnic, or local identity, and who want to sustain and uphold traditional identities in the face of what they see as subversive, radical change that is undermining them. And we can see this new division appearing in country after country. So, for example, in Poland, the old division has entirely disappeared. The old centre-left party, the former Communist Party, has vanished and is no longer represented in the Sejm. Instead, the division is between, on the one side, the Civic Forum, which is very much a party of the first kind, globalist, broadly liberal, and broadly socially liberal. And on the other side, the Law and Justice Party, which is very much a party of the second kind, authoritarian, culturally traditionalist, Catholic, and that means in the Polish case, and also very economically interventionist. And we can see similar parties of that kind in many other European countries, the Danish People's Party, the Sweden Democrats, Alternative for Deutschland, the Freedom Party in the Netherlands, the Austrian Freedom Party, the Northern League in Italy, the Front National in France, perhaps UKIP in the United Kingdom. Not everywhere, it's worth saying. Spain, Portugal, and Ireland are all interesting exceptions, as is Canada. And there are some countries which are partial exceptions, but this is the general pattern that we can see in most developed democracies. And so what we're seeing is a situation in which the old political alignments are dissolving and new political divisions are taking their place. And what this means is that people who formerly were on the same, quote, side, unquote, now find themselves in opposing groups. And people who were bitter opponents suddenly find themselves allies, because they find that they may still disagree about the matters they disagreed about before, but those are no longer the salient political divisions, and they are in agreement on what increasingly is the issue. To be very concrete about it, you could see how this works, for example, in the case of the arguments about whether or not Britain should leave the European Union, where there are many people who have been bitter opponents about all kinds of issues to do with economics, for example, in the past, but who agree that Britain should leave the European Union on the one side, and on the other side again, people who've been in different parties, but who are strongly committed to the Remain cause on the other. And there's a new kind of division there, which, as I say, is again a division about identity as much as it is about anything to do with politics, or rather economics, or the other things that have been dominating politics for the last 40 years.
The way that I would view this is that Brexit has potentially hastened in Britain the realignment, because it really it gave us an idea of the new fault lines in British politics. Mm. So, for example, Brexit occurred because of a broad coalition of, I suppose, in some ways unexpected fellow travellers came together. It was a coalition of rural Tories, patriotic Northern Heartlands, and a few free marketeers. Do you think that that process has been hastened by Brexit?
Yes, I do. I think that Brexit has been a catalyst which has made the realignment begin to happen more rapidly than perhaps it otherwise would have done. It's worth saying that historically, in countries with a first past the post-electoral system, such as Britain or the United States, realignments tend to happen very, very quickly, apparently. They typically happen historically in about 10 years. So there was a major realignment, for example, between about 1918, 1921 and 1931, which saw the disappearance of the Liberal Party's effective political force and its replacement by the Labour Party, and a quite dramatic transformation also in the Conservative Party, and a change in the whole question of what were the big political issues. Similarly, there was another one a generation before then, between 1886 and 1893, which saw the great split in the Liberal Party over Irish Home Rule, and a major realignment of voting blocks between the Liberals and the Conservatives, with lots and lots of Northern business interests switching from one to the other. That's because what happens in a country where there's a first-past-the-post system is that the pressure for realignment and the underlying cultural change that drives it takes place over quite a long period. But it's very hard to get this translated into votes in Parliament or general elections because of the way the electoral system works, which means that when it does actually happen, it tends to happen quite quickly. And typically what you find is there is some kind of major crisis which acts as a catalyst or trigger for that realignment. So it was Irish Home Rule in 1886. It appears to be Brexit this time in the UK. On the other hand, in countries which have a proportional representation system of elections, the change takes place over a slightly longer period, because you begin to see the emergence of new political forms and the emergence of new political arguments over a rather longer period, over three or four electoral cycles, rather than happening quite so suddenly. So a realignment in, say, the Netherlands or in Germany will typically take place over about 15 to 20 years rather than about 10.
Speaking of two countries which have seen dramatic political change in the last year, Britain and the US, from many onlookers it would seem to be the time is completely ripe for realignments in both of these countries because of Brexit, as we talked about. But also, the US election had essentially two of the most unpopular candidates of all time. But because of the nature of the system, it would be extremely difficult for free market-minded Democrats and Republicans to come together against the protectionism of Trump.
It's true that at the moment it's hard to see how the free market or free trade-oriented members of the Democratic and Republican parties can come together in the United States. However, it's worth understanding more in terms of realignment what the election of Donald Trump actually represents. The reason why he won the election, and before that got the Republican nomination, was because he was able to appeal to a significant constituency that had historically not been voting for quite a long time. And this constituency happened to be strongly geographically concentrated in what were key states in getting the Electoral College majority, places like Pennsylvania, Ohio, Michigan, and Wisconsin, and also partly Minnesota, which Trump narrowly missed out on taking. These are essentially older, largely white, working class or ex-working class voters in the decayed ex-industrial areas of those states, places like Scranton Wilkes-Barre in Pennsylvania or Youngstown in Ohio or Flint in Michigan, that kind of place. Now, if you look at the program that Trump ran on and which attracted these people, what was it? Well, it was exactly the kind of one that I described. It combines economic nationalism and protectionism with cultural conservatism and traditionalism, strong nationalism and assertion of national self-interest, and anti-globalism. And that's clearly a appeal which has a very strong appeal, I should say, to that particular kind of critical voting constituency. Now, a significant part of the people who have historically voted Republican are actually not at all happy about that, because they disagree with the protectionism, they don't like the economic nationalism so much, they may not be that keen on the cultural traditionalism. The problem is that at the moment it's very hard for them to make common cause with their sort of counterparts who agree with them on globalism, free trade and the like in the Democratic Party. The Democratic Party in turn is divided between people who belong to the kind of moderate pro-globalist, pro-free trade, broadly pro-market bloc on the one side, and on the other side a much more radical left, which in many ways shares many of the same views and beliefs as Trump, much as they would hate to admit that or own up to it. It's worth pointing out, for example, that Trump's own personal views, so far as we can tell, on healthcare, for example, are well to the left of most people in the Democratic Party, never mind the Republican Party, since he's in favour of a single-payer solution to the replacing of Obamacare. So what I think will happen is that there will be a period in which one side of politics, and this is true not just in the United States but elsewhere, is fairly coherent and organised, the consistently authoritarian side, but in which the more liberal side is divided between what you might call left liberals and right liberals. Liberals who are still social democratic in their economic approach, and liberals who are more free market. And it will probably take a couple of electoral cycles before those two groups of liberals realise that the real division that matters now in politics is between themselves and the anti-liberal forces of the national collectivist right, as I suppose we will call it.
But from a free marketeer perspective, as you've said, that what you call the consistent libertarians are very much politically homeless at present. Globalisation seems to be highly unpopular in many quarters. What is your prognosis for people of our political persuasion? Is there any way that this particular worldview could profit from the coming realignment?
My prognosis for libertarianism is, in the short run, very grim. In the medium term, good. As I explained earlier, the problem for consistent libertarians or classical liberals since the 1970s has been that they're politically homeless, because they agree with half of what one side of the dominant divide think and half of what the other side of the dominant divide think. This can be to your advantage in the sense it enables you to engage in dialogue with both sides and you become swing voters that both sides try to appeal to. But broadly speaking, it means that there's no effective political vehicle for articulating that your worldview. Now, in the short run, I think that the people who are definitely in the ascendancy and who are gaining more and more victories are what I would call the collectivist nationalist right. The people like the phenomenon that Donald Trump is fronting. People like the Austrian Freedom Party or the Law and Justice Party. And this is essentially anti-liberal politics of a very profoundly alarming kind. I mean, these people are wrong about everything, not just one part of the political debate. But unfortunately at the moment, because the broadly liberal opposition is divided over economic issues, I think that they are going to win most of the victories in the short term. And it is going to become very, very difficult in the next 10 years or so for people of a liberal persuasion. However, what I think will happen is that this threat will actually bring liberals of all kinds much more closely together. And I think that you are going to see the emergence of what you might call libertarian light parties as the major alternative to the national collectivists. And what I think will have to happen is a kind of historic compromise on the part of both social democratic liberals, social liberals on the one side, and classical liberals on the other. And I think that the classical liberals will probably have to give ground on redistribution and accept a much larger degree of government redistribution of income than they would probably like in their purely best world. And on the other side, the social democratic liberals will have to give up much more in terms of high levels of government spending and also regulation, and that's going to be the kind of compromise. But they will realise that they have to get their act together, because otherwise they're not going to be able to put together a coalition which will defeat the xenophobic collectivist nationalists. And after a couple of bad beatings, I think this will force them to do this. So my short-term prognosis is rather gloomy, but my medium-term prognosis is actually quite upbeat.
Well, I think we can all get behind libertarian light. Good to end on a note of optimism there, Steve. Thanks ever so much.